From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the Trump ceasefire deal in the Middle East, will it hold? Also, how the continuing government shutdown is affecting U.S. farmers. Michelle Steele on sports, who will take on the Dodgers and the Blue Jays? Moss, Swamp, and Murder in Bog Queen, Anna North's new novel. And singer Rhett Miller prepared for his throat surgery by going into a studio.
And I wanted to be able to make sure I got at least one more record in the can in the case that something went wrong.
But he's good and talks to us about his new album, A Lifetime of Writing by Night. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, October 11, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has confirmed zebra mussels in two western Minnesota lakes. Munson Lake near Detroit Lakes in Becker County and Lake 6 near Frazee in Ottertail County are the latest to join the infested waters list. Property owners contacted DNR officials in both cases after finding adult zebra mussels on equipment like boat lifts. When removing this equipment for seasonal storage, the DNR asked residents to carefully inspect for invasive species. Energy leaders and state partners gathered Wednesday at a groundbreaking celebration for the Northland Reliability Project. The transmission project is aimed at boosting grid reliability and resilience in northern and central Minnesota as the clean energy transition continues. Jointly owned by Minnesota Power and Great River Energy, the Northland Reliability Project is the first major transmission initiative in the Midwest region to break ground. Leaders from Minnesota Power, Great River Energy, the Mid-Continent Independent Operator, the State Department of Commerce, and the Public Utilities Commission were among those who attended the event in Becker. The 180-mile transmission line will extend from near Grand Rapids to near St. Cloud and largely follows existing transmission line corridors. Construction began this fall in Benton and Sherburne counties and will begin on the northern segment in 2026, with the route running through Itasca, Aiken, Crow Wing, and Morrison counties. The transmission line is expected to be in service by 2030. More than 53,000 college students in Minnesota were aided by the state's free tuition program in its first year. A new summary of the benefit for low-income students is drawing optimism in the higher ed community, even with other financial pressures still a concern. Launched last fall, Minnesota's North Star Promise covers tuition and fees for students with a household income of less than $80,000. State officials say the number of recipients exceeded expectations, helping carve out positive enrollment trends. Molly Loitz of Lead MN, which works with students at community and technical colleges, agrees these numbers reflect a strong appetite for people to overcome cost barriers and head to class.
As we recover, sort of still from pandemic losses in enrollment, the North Star Promise is an effective tool in encouraging and enabling college attendance and access.
Loit says even though two-year schools are known for lower tuition, a recent survey of students in the Minnesota system revealed that 97% of respondents labeled access and affordability as a top priority. She says when you factor in books, cost of living, and childcare needs, and stack them up against available grants, college affordability is still very elusive. Loitz hopes Minnesota funds North Star Promise as much as it can in the years ahead, citing a layer of uncertainty that has clouded federal Pell grants. This summer's tax cut package, pushed through by Republicans in Washington, didn't include major cuts initially proposed, but there were some eligibility changes analysts say will limit access for some students. Loitz says states need to fill these gaps.
We know in Minnesota we value higher education, and so making sure that there is robust support and continued funding for programs like North Star Promise so that we can continue to meet our attainment goal of 70% of Minnesota adults holding a degree or certificate.
Minnesota established that goal a decade ago in hopes of reaching 70% in 2025. But the latest available numbers show the state's attainment rate only at 63%. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. A large apartment complex is in the works in the city of Brainerd. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the Voyager Heights apartments include five 38-unit apartment buildings that would accommodate a total of 190 units. It also includes future commercial space that would front Business Highway 371 and allows for expansion of both residential and commercial uses. The apartments would be a mix of studio, one-bedroom and two-bedroom, and the anticipated monthly rent starts at $995. The developer Keepers Inc. has built more than 5,000 apartment units in over 30 Minnesota communities. The city's planning commission recommended approval of the project on a 5-1 vote, citing Brainerd's significant need for more housing. The city council unanimously approved the first reading of an ordinance that would allow for the rezoning of the parcels in question and gave other necessary approvals. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The U.S.-brokered peace deal between Israel and Hamas has entered its second day. The first phase includes a ceasefire and partial Israeli military withdrawal. It also requires Hamas to release all 20 of the living hostages held since October 7, 2023, as well as the bodies of those who have died. In exchange, Israel will release nearly 2,000 prisoners and detainees, most of them held without any charges. Of course, the bulk of the deal remains up for negotiation. Shibley Telhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Professor Telhami, thanks for being back with us.
Good morning to you.
Why do you think both parties agreed to this deal?
Well, I think it's, as the President Trump has actually said, both parties are certainly exhausted. But in the end, I think the Trump administration decided that a ceasefire is really needed, particularly, I think, given strategic shifts that have taken place within the U.S., the Trump administration is feeding the heat. Half of Americans now believe that what's happening in Gaza is genocide. His own supporters are divided, with many very angry with what's happening in Gaza and his support for Israel, and internationally, particularly after Israel had actually launched the attack on Qatar, an American ally, that shifted even the way states have been thinking about their relationship with the U.S. and Israel. All of this really put a lot of pressure on the Trump administration to act, but let's be real here. What's also happened is that essentially the Arab allies have persuaded Hamas that it's wise, even up front, to release all the Israeli hostages. It has seen those hostages essentially as bargaining chips with Israel, and it has been persuaded otherwise. So all of these things have come together, but what we really have, and let's be clear, is not really a more than essentially a hostage release deal, ceasefire with uncertain term, and a prayer. That's what we have. We don't have a peace deal.
Well, let me ask you about one of the items on this really 20-point plan is the demilitarization of Gaza, which would entail the disarmament of Hamas and dismantling what Israel says is Hamas infrastructure. Is that a popular idea among Palestinians?
Well, let's put it this way. First of all, Hamas has agreed only to phase one. All of these other points of the plan, many of them Hamas has not agreed to, so these would have to be negotiated. This has always been an Israeli demand, and certainly it is part of what has part of the 20-point plan that the Trump administration put together. Hamas itself has said that it is prepared in the context of a Palestinian takeover of a national agreement not to be part of governing Gaza. So they have not really, accepted this idea. And that obviously leaves so much vagueness that they can exploit, just like the Israeli government can exploit all the vagueness. So Palestinians are divided on this. In part, many of them don't agree with Hamas, but feel that it has the right to fight the Israeli occupation. So it's a divided issue, but nothing has agreed on this issue at this point.
How realistic is a two-state solution right now?
I've always believed, and I've written about this before October 2023, saying, the promise of two-state has become essentially a smokescreen to hide a one-state unjust reality that has existed. I think since in the last 2 years, that reality has been entrenched. I think the main issue remains the same, which is the position of the American government. As you know, what we have is an increasing international recognition of two states, including in Europe. But the U.S. Is the main party here, preventing it from happening by not allowing the Security Council to admit a state of Palestine and recognizing it, but also essentially in enabling Israeli action. Much countered the idea of two states, including obviously settlement building in the West Bank and beyond.
Is there regional support for this peace plan? I apologize, we just have half a minute left.
No, yes, I think there is regional. I think everybody is desperate. They haven't been able to stop the carnage in Gaza. Public opinion is going against the governments, and everybody wants to see some end to it. And so they're they're seizing the moment here, but it's really they're basing their faith on Trump being able to stay the course and deliver, and that is way too much to hope for.
Shibli Talhami, thanks very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
It's the second week of a government shutdown. Federal employees are feeling the pain. People who rely on the government to make a living are also suffering, including Midwestern farmers who are cut off from government financing and information at a critical time. Frank Morris of member station KCUR in Kansas City joins us. Frank, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
And how's the shutdown affecting farmers?
So farmers work very closely with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and over the decades, it's developed programs to help cope with drought, floods, disease, and market collapse. It's also a reliable source of vital information. Richard Oswald grows corn and soybeans in northeast Missouri, says closing down most of USDA causes real problems.
I think it affects a lot of things. We aren't having USDA reports on the crop yields or the crop progress.
Which means buyers don't really know how big the harvest is turning out to be. And Oswald thinks if they did, the price of his grain would go up. And that's important because he's currently losing money on everything he harvests.
Government, though, also gives money and loans to farmers to help tide them over in difficult times. What's going on with that?
Yeah, that's largely just stopped. And again, the timing's bad. Tariffs and other factors are driving up the price of almost everything farmers need to buy. But the prices they're getting for their grain are still low. And normally in hard times like this, Oswald said he says he'd take out a loan through the USDA to get through until he could sell for a profit. Now it's not there, right when he could really use the help.
So is the shutdown hitting just as farmers need the government the most?
Yeah, basically, harvest, the fall is time of year when farmers' bills are coming due and they're trying to make decisions on how to market their grain. Farmers say there's never a good time to shut down USDA, but Chad Hart, an economist at Iowa State University, says right now farmers are especially vulnerable.
This is one of the worst times within the year to shut down USDA. You combine that with you're shutting it down at a time when the ag economy is in a recession, so it's sort of a double barrel hit there.
Now, Hart says many farmers have been losing money each year for three or four years straight. President Trump is promising a bailout. That's delayed. An announcement was supposed to come last week, but even if Trump announced a bailout tomorrow, it's not clear how the money would be distributed to farmers without a functioning USDA.
Where does this all leave farmers?
Well, it's kind of mixed. Cattle farmers are making money hand over fist at the moment because beef prices are so high. But corn, soybean, and wheat farmers are really in survival mode. Kansas farmer Jack Geiger says he's just putting his head down, taking the losses in stride, and working hard at the things he can control, like getting his soybean crop in before the weather changes.
This year is kind of done. And the reality of the situation is right now, farmers are running their combines and they're gaming out next year. How do we survive next year?
And the fact is, not every farmer out there harvesting right now is going to make it to next year. Economists expect a spate of farm bankruptcies.
Frank Morris from member station KCUR. Frank, thanks so much for your reporting and for joining us this morning.
You bet, Scott. Thank you.
What is it like to enter Rome's Colosseum like an emperor? Well, visitors can get an idea later this month when the Commodus Passage opens to the public after a restoration. The underground tunnel once allowed emperors to walk unseen to the imperial box where they could sit or stand, maybe recline on comfy pillows and watch the spectacles on the gaming fields below. But in the 180-foot tunnel, they might see a preview. The stucco work there was etched with scenes of gladiators, bear fights, and acrobats. It also had depictions of moments from myths, like when Bacchus, the god of wine, fell for the Cretan princess Ariadne. The passage was named in the 1810s after the Emperor Commodus. Name sound familiar? He was the son of Marcus Aurelius. Still can't place him? Well, he was played by Joaquin Phoenix in the movie Gladiator. Commodus was a brutal and inept ruler. He executed senators. He imagined himself as Hercules. He dressed as a gladiator and killed lions in the arena that he renamed Rome, Colony of Commodus. He's linked to the Colosseum's tunnel because some historical accounts say he survived an assassination attempt there. In reality, his advisors arranged in 192 CE for a champion wrestler named Narcissus to strangle him to death in his bath. Maybe Commodus just should have stayed in the tunnel. Friends, Romans, you're listening to NPR News.
18 minutes after 8 o'clock, you're listening to People-Powered KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. United Way Bemidji will distribute coats for the community today from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church on Bemidji Avenue North. Anyone in need of winter items is welcome. And the City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offers woodsy walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30. Free and open to all, meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. And you can take a walk on the Haunted Trail at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd October 16th through the 18th from 7 to 9 each evening. Choose from low scare, high scare, or insane high scare options. Thanks for listening to KAXC this morning.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands. With therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone. At BetterHelp.com/public. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene told NBC News this week,
"I'm not some sort of blind slave to the president, and I don't think anyone should be. And I'm not elected by the president. I'm not elected by anyone that works in the White House. I'm elected by my district. That's who I work for. And I got elected without the president's endorsement. And, you know, I think that has served me really well."
Representative Greene is calling on her fellow Republicans to end the government shutdown by working with Democrats to extend Affordable Care Act subsidies. Her outspokenness on this issue and others is just one item of Georgia politics these days. We're joined now by Greg Bluestein. He's chief political correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How much does this most recent break from Republican leadership fit into Marjorie Taylor Greene's broader moves?
I mean, she's always been such a maverick in Georgia politics, but lately it's really felt like she's even more of a wild card. Ever since she decided not to run for U.S. Senate for the spot challenging Senator John Ossoff, maybe the most vulnerable Democratic incumbent on the midterm ballot, ever since she made that decision, she has been even more of a maverick, even more of a wild card. For the first time, really, that I can remember in Georgia politics, a bunch of Democrats are now praising Marjorie Taylor Greene, saying, I didn't think we could ever say this, but I agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene.
How have her constituents reacted?
Well, she is in a very, very red district up in northwest Georgia. There's been Democratic challengers to her that have raised lots of money, but really made no headway. So she's safe politically. Her constituents, by her accounts, about 60% of them have agreed with her stance. Time and time again, we will talk to her constituents who say they might not like everything she says on Twitter or on social media or on TV, but they agree with most of her votes. By some projections, ending these federal subsidies could affect more than 1.4 million Georgians. So to many of her constituents, she's not just speaking as a lawmaker, she's speaking as a mom whose children will have to pay more in health care insurance.
And of course, this comes as there are two big races next year in Georgia for the Senate and for governor. What so far seems to be the major themes for both those campaigns?
Well, the biggest theme, I think, is it is wide open for both races. Other than John Ossoff, the incumbent Democratic senator, there seems to be a candidate for every lane. You have candidates in the governor's race from the far left to former Republican Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan, now running as a moderate Democrat. And then, of course, on the Republican side of that governor's race, you've got MAGA allies. You've also got Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, who famously defied Donald Trump's demand to find just enough votes to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia.
What about the economy? What kind of issue is that?
Yeah, every poll that I've seen in Georgia, economy and jobs and inflation have always been the top issue. And I don't think that's going to change. But we have started to see, at least in polls of Democratic voters, a number two is standing up to Donald Trump. And that reflects a lot of Democratic voters, especially the more liberal and progressive ones, who want a more confrontational, aggressive approach to the president. And there's candidates who are promising to do that in 2026. And there's others who are saying, no, look, we need to figure out ways we can work with the Republicans.
And what are the issues on the Republican side?
Trump shadows everything as well. On the Senate race, for instance, there's pretty much a three-person race for Donald Trump's endorsement right now. There's former football coach Derek Dooley and Congressman Mike Collins and Buddy Carter. Derek Dooley is probably the least known of any of them. He has a famous last name thanks to his father, the legendary University of Georgia football coach. He has Governor Kemp's endorsement, though, so that helps him a lot. On the other side, the other two candidates, Collins and Carter, they're both depicting themselves as MAGA warriors who are going to be President Trump's biggest ally in the Senate should they win.
Where do a lot of Georgians see themselves fitting into the national landscape of politics now?
You know, we went from a state that was an afterthought I remember in the 2016 presidential election, neither Trump nor Clinton even came to Georgia after the primary. They never had substantial operations in Georgia or big campaign rallies, and nor did they really need to. I mean, Donald Trump was always favored to win Georgia. He did. But in the process of 2016, he lost the Atlanta suburbs, and that was the first real inkling that Georgia was being competitive. And now we're used to being competitive. Now there's even voter fatigue because there have been so many competitive elections. You know, close to $1 billion was spent in Georgia during the 2020 campaign. About $500 million was spent in 2022. So you're going into 2026. Yes, Georgia's still a battleground. Is it blue? No. Is it red? No. It's probably a sort of darker shade of purple right now, but certainly still one of the most competitive places in the nation.
Greg Bluestein is chief political correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And out of the sprightly notes of B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music, it's time for sports. Baseball playoffs. The Seattle Mariners win an instant classic. Brewers Cubs tonight. WNBA, the Aces ace it. And we say goodbye to Sister Jean. But first, hello to sports reporter Michelle Steele. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. I need another coffee.
Oh, my gosh, what a classic last night.
Oh, yeah.
15 innings, extra innings, obviously, the Mariners over the Detroit Tigers. Seattle, I believe, first time since 2001, right?
Yes.
They faced the Toronto Blue Jays. What do you look for in a Jays-Mariners series?
Yeah, I do want to give a little bit of shine here to last night's game, though. I stayed up for all of it, 15 innings. Mariners prevailing 3-2 after Jorge Polanco walked off the Tigers. And, Scott, this is the first time that they're going to the ALCS, you're right, since 2001. And if they win, they're four wins away from the first ever World Series appearance for Seattle, the only team never to make a World Series. I'm excited about a Jays-Mariners ALCS. You know, it's real offense versus pitching kind of matchup. Toronto's lineup, relentless. Best batting average in Major League Baseball. They don't strike out too much. And we know from last night's game, boy, do they have a deep and talented rotation in Seattle. We'll see how much they have in the tank, though, for Game 1 against a very well-rested Jays team tomorrow.
And in the National League tonight, as I believe both you and I know, Game 5. Milwaukee Brewers versus the Chicago Cubs for the honor of meeting the Dodgers. Look, both the Cubs and Brewers have had magic at times this year. Milwaukee maybe a little more. What do you look for tonight?
Well, for me personally, I'm going to look for smelling salts. I didn't have a dog in the fight last night, and I'm white. But what I'm expecting tonight is for this to be a true bullpen game, Scott. As of late Friday, neither the Brewers or the Cubs had named a starter, indicating that this is going to be a real all-hands-on-deck approach, right, for both sides. Cubs manager Craig Counsell, you might have already seen it, saying we have 11 pitchers to figure out how to get to 27 outs. Here's a crazy stat for you. I bet you already know this. The Cubs have scored in the first inning of all four games in this series, hitting a home run in each one. Can they jump out to an early lead, right, and put some pressure on the Brewers at home? You're a Cubs diehard. You feeling good?
Cautiously good. Let's put it that way.
I'm optimism.
You know me. Michelle, I just hope it's a clean game with good sportsmanship on both sides.
Well, let's not go to 15 innings. How about that?
All right. Las Vegas Aces completed their sweep of the Phoenix Mercury, third WNBA championship in 4 years. Is this the new dynasty?
I think so. First WNBA team in 25 years to win three championships in the last four seasons. And they're owned by Mark Davis, who historically has been considered one of the more dysfunctional teams in the NFL. The other team that he owns, the Las Vegas Raiders. In the WNBA, he's a veritable George Steinbrenner, Scott. He's hired the right people in the front office. He got the right head coach in Becky Hammon, used to be a Spurs assistant. Yeah. They have a dominant core led by Asia Wilson. He's given the team player resources that did not exist in the W before the Aces came onto the scene. So congrats to them. Congrats to Mark Davis. Good luck to the WNBA, because now they're going to try to negotiate a tricky new contract for players.
Finally, Sister Jean, the chaplain and number one fan of Loyola University Chicago's basketball team, has died at the age of 106. She retired just a couple of weeks ago. You covered her. You knew her. What a loss. Bless her.
I'll say so. I covered their magical run in 2018, talked to her during the pandemic, and checked in with her not too long ago. And I was just here talking about her two weeks ago, Scott. She had devoted her whole life to teaching, to ministering to youth. You know, she even taught Bob Hope's kids when she was a much younger sister in Southern California. Her vocation was her calling, of course, but her calling, I think, was really helping young people. She loved basketball. She loved Loyola. She loved the program. And this is my personal opinion, but when she retired, her work in a lot of ways was done. And 106 years, what a life well lived.
Gosh, yes. Michelle Steele, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
See you next time.
This year's Nobel Peace Prize went to Maria Corina Machado for her, quote, tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela. But another group had been considered a strong contender, the Sudan Emergency Response Rooms, a network of thousands of volunteers within Sudan who've responded to the ongoing civil war there by providing food, shelter, and medical assistance to those in need. Reporter Ari Daniel has this profile of a woman involved with the group, and we are only using her first name because its members have been targeted by both sides of the war.
Amasi grew up in Darfur in western Sudan, where life was fairly ordinary.
We are living in a good situation. Our little brothers and sisters goes to the schools. We are going to our universities. We have dreams to graduate.
But when the civil war broke out almost 2.5 years ago, all of that evaporated.
Life is kind of stopped. Our house and our country and our universities all had damage, the lack of food, the lack of water, and the people afraid and the children cries.
After a year, Amasi fled her home, becoming one of over 12 million Sudanese who've been internally displaced due to the conflict. She made it to the eastern part of the country on the coast and was able to resume her studies. She also found her way into a WhatsApp group affiliated with the Sudan Emergency Response Rooms.
I understand they are doing great things to the people. They are trying to send to them food, clean water. They are our sisters, they are our brothers and mothers and fathers and uncles. So you will do your best to save them.
Amasi joined as a volunteer. Her role was to figure out what type of assistance would most benefit different families and communities in need, medical supplies or cooked communal meals or cash so they could purchase what they needed themselves.
It feels like life saving, and you feel, you know, that kind of peace and that kind of happiness.
Amasi says the work is steeped in a long-standing Sudanese value called nafir, which she says means collective work or action.
If you have a house to build, all the neighbors there will come to you and help you in building your house, kind of volunteering. So it's kindness of Sudanese and their love to their country, to their neighbors.
The work isn't always easy. With unreliable phone and internet connections, it can be hard to know what's happening on the ground. And sometimes local organizers will go to a market to buy food or supplies and bump into a soldier who peppers them with questions.
Who are you? What are you doing? Some people, they can't just understand that you are just seeking for peace, trying to help the people who are suffering from the war.
The Sudan Emergency Response Rooms didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize, but they did win a couple of other big humanitarian prizes this year, including the Right Livelihood Award, sometimes referred to as the Alternative Nobel. Amasi says such recognition helps attract attention to the group, even within Sudan.
It motivates people to enter in this work.
As Amasi looks ahead, all she wants is for this terrible war that's torn her country and community apart to stop.
If it's stopped, we are trying to do our best to go ahead to improve our country, our people, try to develop the schools, the universities, the healthcare.
And above all, Amasi says, to make sure that everyone, from the children to the elderly, is aware of their right to live in peace. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
He You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Social media personalities are shaping the public's understanding of a possible National Guard troop deployment to Portland, Oregon. Right-wing influencers are now working with the federal government to try to promote its message, as Eric Newman of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
On Tuesday, Benny Johnson, a pro-Trump social media personality from Florida, arrived here.
Yo, what's up? We are on the ground in Portland, Oregon.
Johnson and three other social media influencers met with DHS Secretary Kristi Noem and toured the ICE facility, where there have been protests since June.
The Trump administration is here today. Follow along. The Trump administration ain't going to have any of this. It's going to be a rowdy day.
Standing on the rooftop, Johnson and the other influencers filmed Noem for their millions of viewers online. But it wasn't rowdy. On the street below, around 20 reporters from local and national outlets stood behind yellow caution tape, along with a dozen protesters. It was a sunny fall day in Portland, far from the burning hellscape portrayed online. Still, influencer Nick Sorter warned Noem that she wasn't seeing the real story.
This is absolutely nothing as to what it is at night, though.
No,
it's really bad at night. Yeah, that sun goes down and it gets totally lawless.
This kind of media access is an example of how the Trump administration is working with right-wing influencers to shape the public's understanding of events. Local media have not been given the same access when they requested it. A.J. Bauer is an assistant professor who studies media activism at the University of Alabama. He says the current Trump administration is working with these influencers to justify the president's actions.
The streamers are actually counter-protesters themselves who are going and documenting the protests that they disagree with. The government is actually working hand in glove with those folks in order to promote the government's message.
Bauer says right-wing influencers don't follow the journalistic norms of balance and independence. Instead, he says, they start out with an ideological vision of the world and then narrate what they see in a way that fits that vision.
The consequences are that we've got two competing visions of reality.
There have been almost nightly protests outside of Portland's ICE facility for months. Since June, the Portland Police Bureau has made at least 47 arrests, and federal officials have arrested dozens more, though not everyone has been charged with a crime. The protests themselves span just one or two city blocks. But these influencers spin a story that chaos is rampant, and now they're having the biggest impact possible by shaping how President Trump views the protests. They repeated that vision to him at a White House roundtable on Wednesday.
The amazing thing is you look at Portland, and you see fires all over the place. You see fights and, I mean, just violence.
Oregon officials have rejected the need to send in the National Guard. Matt Tardio is a conservative podcaster who regularly live streams these protests. On a recent night outside the ICE facility, he said he's trying to capture everything that's going on, not just the clashes between protesters and police.
I do know that I've caught some coming up streamers or whatever they were trying to be actually legitimately trying to start problems and having hidden cameramen off to the side trying to capture those problems starting so that they can have their viral clips. That's messed up.
Tardio, who is a veteran, agrees that the online perception is exaggerated.
I can't tell you the amount of times I said, I don't feel the National Guard needs to come out here.
But that hasn't stopped other influencers from repeating the story about a war-ravaged city that gets amplified by Trump officials and repackaged across the conservative media ecosystem. For NPR News, I'm Eric Newman in Portland, Oregon.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and Weekend Edition. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 8:39. Support for KAXE comes from the McKnight Foundation and from listeners like you who become members. You can give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you so much for your support. Looks like a nice day here in northern Minnesota. Sunny temperatures in the low to mid-60s, however breezy southwest winds. Lows tonight near 50 and tomorrow breezy, mostly cloudy, good chance of showers. Temperatures in the mid to upper 60s. Looking ahead to Monday, sunny and a bit cooler, highs in the mid-50s. Grand Rapids artist Tom Page hosts a pop-up show today from 2 to 6 at Clockwell Brewing. Page will give a brief talk and introduce models from his paintings at 4 o'clock. And Trinity Lutheran Church on Highway 71 in Lake George has a lutefisk supper this evening, 4 to 7:30. They will also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. As Palestinians return to a devastated northern Gaza, President Trump says he believes the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas will hold. Trump is expected to visit the region on Monday to address Israel's parliament and to meet with world leaders in Cairo. Officials in the Philippines are warning of aftershocks following two earthquakes that struck offshore yesterday. At least seven people were killed, and towns near the epicenter suffered structural damage. And North Korea held a massive military parade last night, celebrating the 80th anniversary of the ruling Workers' Party. The parade showcased military weapons, including a new intercontinental ballistic missile. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Legacy Box, committed to saving aging tapes and photos by bringing them to life in digital form, then making them accessible in Legacy Box Cloud. Learn more at legacybox.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Anna North's new novel captures attention even before the first page. The dedication is for the moss.
A colony of moss does not experience emotions like fondness or intimacy. But if it did, it might say this: we held her. We kept her safe under the surface, in our bath of earth, for many times her lifespan. That we give her up now may seem to be purely random, an accident of excavation. In fact, the hour of her service is at hand.
Bog Queen begins when a body is found in a British bog. An American forensic anthropologist, Agnes, is brought in to investigate. The bog body seems almost completely preserved, but its bones reveal that it, or she, is from the Iron Age, more than 2,000 years ago. What is the story of the woman in the bog? Bog Queen is the latest novel from Anna North. She joins us from her studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Why did you want to write a novel about peat bogs? And, if I may, bog bodies?
I actually find these bodies and the idea of them really beautiful. I first saw a bog body in the British Museum, and I just thought, how amazing. This is a real person who lived and breathed thousands of years ago, and I can still see him, and we can learn so much about him and his life from his body and from studying him. And his people buried him in this place where I think they knew that he would be preserved, and I can imagine them, you know, hoping that maybe we would understand them one day. I visited the bog where he was found. I really learned so much from that landscape, which today is quite degraded from its former state, but it's still breathtaking to see. And there are spots of real biodiversity that could come back if protected properly. So I really got obsessed with bogs themselves and with the moss that creates the bogs and the way it can operate as a colony, not as a single organism. And I really wanted in this book to talk about the non-human world. I think that people tend to think that we always drive events on the earth, but there are many other organisms here that have huge impact on us and our lives, and I really wanted to share that too.
Agnes, the forensic anthropologist, what did she begin to feel for the dead woman?
I think something that I loved about Agnes as she sort of took shape in my mind is her sense of care and responsibility toward the dead, and her sense that our duty of care toward human beings doesn't necessarily stop when someone dies, but continues towards their body. But the body that she's called to investigate at the bog in England is different and causes her to really expand her definition of what her responsibilities are and what she is sort of put into this world to care for.
We learn that the woman of the Iron Age is a druid. What was her life like?
So this was a really fun part of the book to research. I did a lot of research on life in Britain in the Iron Age. It was fascinating to me, you know, all that we don't know. Britons at that time didn't have written language, so there are a lot of questions that we have. There are some suggestions in the literature that Druids, in addition to playing a religious role, might have been sort of political leaders. And so in my mind, I thought of this young woman who is very smart. She's very driven. She's almost like a wannabe be cosmopolitan, and yet maybe she overestimates her own power a tiny bit in ways that come back to haunt her.
The narrative voice goes back and forth between the two women, telling us of their two lives, 2,000 years apart. Do we begin to recognize some common notes between the two?
I think we do. Both of these women are really passionate about their work in different ways and in different definitions of the word work. They, in some ways, are very self-centered or self-absorbed even, and they have to learn to look outside themselves. They're deeply curious, and they're driven by their curiosity, I think especially in the case of the Druid, who comes from a place that's quite small and really wants to see and be a part of the wider world. I think for Agnes, the anthropologist, studying the bog and the body really brings her in touch with the wider world in a way that she hasn't been previously.
You have a character who asks later on, and her argument made me think, asks of Agnes, have you ever considered that maybe this body should have stayed buried? Do you think they wanted her to be poked and prodded by people who didn't know her or care about her?
This is a question I think about a lot, and it's a question that has been asked about real-life bog bodies. So there have been, you know, protests and efforts to return these bodies to the soil or to have them sort of away from the prying eyes of the public in museums. And I do really understand those protests, even as I have been really moved by being able to see these remains. So I wanted to capture that, too, in the book, that sense of, one, this is a human, we can learn so much. Two, like, this is a human. Should we be doing this? What is the value of knowledge versus what is the value of respecting something or trying to respect something, trying to respect it in the way that it might have been respected in its time?
Mm. Does excavation of the bog to analyze what might have happened to the woman, what kind of society she came from, collide with those who want to rewild the moss now?
It does. It's one of the central tensions of the book, is sort of reconciling what Agnes is doing with environmentalists who want to protect the bog. And bogs are actually, and peatlands in general, are one of the most important carbon sinks in the world. They store an enormous amount of carbon. And I'm actually working right now on a journalistic piece about this, looking at mining and other developments that's disturbing bogs around the world. Mm-hmm. I found that even, you know, pretty small amounts of activity, pretty small amounts of drilling can really damage a bog ecosystem. So looking back at my book, I do think both sides have a real claim here. Like, Agnes wants to find out what happened to this body, but I think the environmentalists are correct that even any excavation poses a risk to this landscape that's literally like standing between us and climate change.
I mean, I want to give anything away, but at one point the moss says, eventually we triumph.
I think it can be a time of really deep despair if you are a human who cares about the earth, if you're a human who cares about climate, even if you're a human who cares about other humans. And I think it is important and also cheering to remember that some of these organisms have been around a lot longer than us, and some of them will be around after we're gone. You know, sphagnum moss is thousands of years old. As I say in the book, colony of moss does not speak, yet if it could, I think it would tell us that some of our human dramas are not important to it at all.
Anna North's new novel, Bog Queen. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Before he was rolled into the operating room, Rhett Miller made sure to hit the recording studio.
Right in the heels of the 7-day storm, laughing together and drinking alone.
It was late last year, and the singer and songwriter needed to have a cyst removed from his vocal cords. Before we get to that surgery, let's talk about the results of those studio sessions, a lifetime of writing by night is Rhett Miller's 10th solo album, and he joins us now from a tour stop in Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's nice to be with you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And we'll get to you. when you're not working solo, of course, you're a lead singer of the band Old 97s, which was recently honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award, the Americana Music Association Festival in Nashville. What's that mean to you?
It was a trip. I am not going to lie. Sitting in the Ryman Auditorium with all those brilliant artists there, and I had my mom with me, who's in her early 80s. Well, I got a time bomb in my mind. I heard a ticket, but I don't know why. Roseanne Cash got up there on that historic stage, and she'd written a speech, and it was incredibly moving. I mean, Rose is a friend, but she's still Roseanne Cash. I didn't think an award or a recognition like that would mean that much to me, because for years I've sort of said that this isn't a beauty pageant, this thing we're doing. But it did, especially a Lifetime Achievement Award, I felt like it was pretty cool.
You know, it occurs to me, what a blessing for any group of four people on this earth, but particularly four people involved in the same enterprise, of which they care deeply about, to stay alive and be together.
Yeah, we laugh about it sometimes, wondering, you know, who's going to be the first to cry uncle. I don't know. I think we might make 50. It'll only have to be 17 and a half more years, Scott.
All right, I'll be counting down.
One of us will wind up buried by a trail, with just a moon to keep a watch. Campfire gutters and the ghosts begin to wail. We leave a cross made out of rocks.
I have to ask, of course, all that singing, all that touring can take a toll on the voice. When did you begin to think, you know, this isn't just a sore throat?
We were in Europe, and it was pretty bare bones, and we didn't have our in-ear monitors that I've gotten really dependent on for not screaming on a stage. And at the end of that run, we were in Edinburgh, and I was trying to make noises come out of my mouth on stage, and it was pretty much not working. And I knew then that something was terribly wrong, so I had to go to the doctor.
Who said?
He said, you have a giant cyst on your vocal fold, which is the same thing apparently as a vocal cord. And it turns out when they talk about a giant cyst on your vocal fold, it's the size of a piece of rice.
So what led to your decision to record this album before your surgery?
I wanted to be able to make sure I got at least one more record in the can in the case that something went wrong. And I used to, in my more fraught younger years, you know, when my mental health wasn't as stable as it is now, I used to think, if I make this record and it's good enough, then whatever happens is fine. Like, I've put out this record in the world. And then as the records stacked up, it became sort of a moot point. Like, okay, now there's enough records. I'm just staying alive because I actually like being alive.
No embarrassment in that, all right? I mean, no.
Times of the morning, at all times of the day, people are lifted and carried away. I don't know what to do, I don't know what to say. People are lifted and carried away.
When you listen to this recording and hear some of the effort you put into some of the notes you sing, I hear, and tell me if I'm wrong, something reminiscent of when Johnny Cash and Frank Sinatra recorded in their later years. I'm very moved by it.
Thank you. I was trying to put on a brave face during the sessions, and I love making music. So being in the studio was a joyful thing, but at the same time, I was really scared. And I know that the success rate of the kind of surgery I had is pretty high. But I also knew that it wasn't a 100% chance of success.
Look, you've worked with Evan Felker of Turnpike Troubadours and Jesse Valenzuela from Gin Blossoms and some other folks on this album. What do collaborations offer?
I love writing songs, and I've never felt like I needed other people. But guess what happens? When you work with other people, they bring something out of you that you would never think to access on your own. And it's something I've really discovered since I've been conducting songwriting workshops, and now I'm a songwriting instructor at a college in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, this is the new school, right? Yeah.
At the new school, yeah, in New York City. And the collaboration that we do is, I mean, it's at the heart of music. I mean, it's all about coming together to make music with other people. And when you write a song, as vulnerable as that is, and as weird as that is, and magical, when you do it with somebody else, it can be even more magical.
And I think I stole a melody to stop you now from leaving me. A little song to make you see.
And I've learned to open up as an artist, as a songwriter. And then, of course, I've learned to think in a more analytical way about songwriting. Like, oh, yeah, if I sing if I sing the word you in a song, I can do this. And it's like this little spell that I cast on the listener. And now when this song comes into their ears, they're in the song because the you that I sang put them in the song.
All for you.
May I ask how you're feeling?
Talking to such an esteemed broadcaster as yourself, having just received a Lifetime Achievement Award while sitting next to my mom in the Ryman Auditorium, about to embark on a West Coast tour, I feel hopeful.
I mean, all of that, it should be more than hopeful, my word.
Yeah.
Hopeful is when you're 16.
You're right. I'm ashamed to admit it, but man, I feel pretty good about all this stuff. I love it. I mean, it's true. You know, I kind of joked about not being sure if I wanted to stick around on this planet when I was younger, but oh man, is it so worth it having stuck around all these years?
Rhett Miller, his new album, A Lifetime of Writing by Night. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It is just before 9 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. There are lots of local news stories and conversations for you to check out. Plus, you can click the donate button and become a member of KAXE. Sunny today with temperatures in the low to mid-60s, breezy south winds, lows tonight near 50, and tomorrow mostly cloudy, good chance of showers, breezy once again, temperatures in the mid to upper 60s. For Monday, mostly sunny and cooler, highs in the mid-50s. Support for KAXE comes from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock this morning, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. That is followed at noon by the history of recorded jazz with Paul Kivi. 1 o'clock, Native Lights, followed by KAXE Rewind. Right now, it is time for Stay Human.
Hi there. It's time for an hour of story and song on Stay Human, the radio show that's not afraid to ask the big questions.